And LPFMs are directly in neighborhoods. You can walk to them from where you can hear them.
Radio is good when the person who you are listening to cares about something passionately.
Welcome to the Radio Survivor Podcast. This is the podcast about radio that matters. From community radio and low power FM to college radio to internet radio, podcasting, independent voices, interesting stuff that serves real communities. I'm Paul Riesmandel, and I am one of your hosts.
I'm Eric Klein, and I am your co-host.
Yes. And today we've got a lot of good stuff coming up, but first we've got a little bit of housekeeping to do, Eric. This is our second podcast, we released the first one with a soft launch. We only told folks who were subscribed to our weekly Radio Survivor Bulletin, our newsletter, which you should subscribe to at radiosurvivor.com. It's good stuff. It's free. Comes to your email. You can't miss it. And then we just let people who are also our patrons on Patreon know about the show. And already we're starting to climb the iTunes charts in the news and politics section. In that category, already today as we record, it's been out for one day. It's up around number 105. I'll be really thrilled when we beat Laura Ingraham and Dennis Miller
wow.
in that category.
So I have to say that this is the most proud I've ever been of anything this week, and yet I am already suspicious. Like, what kind of black box are we talking about?
Yeah, well, the iTunes charts, yes, I know. It is a bit of a black box. And yet it matters because that's where people go to look for new podcasts
right.
to listen to. And so climbing up in the ranks puts us in front of more people, and I hope exposes more people to more independent podcasting and independent radio, and learns more about this wonderful world that so often doesn't get well represented. Well,
even if we peak at 105, I will still pat you and myself on the back.
Oh, yes.
And also continue to be suspicious of the fake accolade.
Of the fake accolade. Well, help us with the fake accolade, won't you?
Let's see what happens.
If you don't mind, go to iTunes and the iTunes store, look up Radio Survivor and subscribe there. There's an opportunity to rate it. You can just click a little star. We suggest 5, but you choose the number of stars you think is appropriate. And also there's an opportunity to leave an actual review. So if you want to do that, that would be great. And again, it's really because we want to expose more people to the show and to more people to the great world of independent and passionate radio. And we hope that we're doing that with the show. So anything you can do, we'd really appreciate it.
I actually want to jump by the gun here. And because you just brought up great radio, Paul, I need to make that the transition to, like, I was thinking about this, like, why are we here on this podcast? And it's because we love radio. And so what is it that we like about it? When is radio good? Is it easy to define that? I came up with a definition.
Okay, I want to hear your definition.
My definition is that radio is good when the person who you are listening to cares about something passionately and is sharing that knowledge that they have and that passion that they have with you. And so that works really well if it's a music DJ who cares about this, either the song they're playing to you right now or this entire genre of music. Or it works if it's, people making fun of terrible movies. They're very passionate about how much they can make their friends laugh as they mock the worst movies ever made. But whatever it is, like podcasting and radio, that's the missing ingredient between good and bad, is that the person who's making it cares.
What about Rush Limbaugh?
He cares. That's great radio. It's not for you if you also don't care
about what he cares about,
right.
or you care about it in the opposite way.
Well, no, that can work too, right? I mean, if you're listening to Rush Limbaugh on a regular basis and you're getting something out of it, if you're motivated by hate,
you know, a lot of Rush Limbaugh's audience are angry liberals who are listening in partially because they want to know what's up, what the other side's up to, mm-hmm. right? And also because they enjoy that little boost that, you know, that, sure. that makes them all the more passionate about their political angle. I like your definition. It's a pretty good working definition, I think. And to me, there's often, I mean, I guess that passion really cuts into it because it cuts into that structural angle too, because it's hard to believe that a voice tracked DJ from a city halfway across the country is actually passionate.
Right. We all know. I mean, children might not have figured that out, but doesn't everyone else know that no one cares about that radio station? You can just tell by listening.
And like one of my favorite commercial radio shows is Little Steven's Underground Garage, which is a syndicated show that all about garage rock, starring Little Steven of the E Street Band with Bruce Springsteen. And it's a show he started on his own, and he syndicated it himself because he couldn't find a syndicator who would pick it up. And you can tell he does this show not because he thought it would be a great product, but because he was truly passionate about garage rock and he wanted to share it. And he had a name, so, you know, it helped get commercial stations to pick it up. But I think, yes, it's passionate. I think that's a great definition, Eric. And maybe we need to work that into our description.
Of Radio Survivor?
Yeah.
Well, we are passionate about good radio.
There you go.
And probably a listener to Radio Survivor podcast is also passionate.
I think that's about a radio. You just said it. We are passionate about good radio.
Ooh.
It doesn't have to be any more complex than that. See, there you go.
I'm glad I jumped the gun and let that one fly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because what was really supposed to happen next was that we were supposed to apologize for a mistake.
Well, we'll do that too.
Okay.
In last episode, our number one episode, we mentioned that there was no college radio in Portland, specifically when you first moved here, but also when I first moved here. And that is only half correct, it turns out. What we should have said is there's no college radio on the air in Portland, but there are college stations that are online. I know that there's KPSU at Portland State University has an online station. And I'm pretty sure Lewis and Clark College has an online station, but they don't presently and didn't at that time have an actual transmitter.
And in addition to apologizing to all the volunteers and workers at those stations for my mistake, I'd love to go to those campuses and find out if any of the students care about the difference
between the online
it matter at all to a 19-year-old that their college station?
It's a perpetual question. It is an actual perpetual question, and I think there does yet seem to be something magical about the transmitter that makes people take you seriously. And that's something which we'll talk about a little bit more in our feature interview a little later in the show with Sabrina Roach, who is a doer with Brown Paper Tickets. And she focuses on all sorts of community information and media infrastructure, specifically these days on low power FM. So we'll get to that question a little bit, but we don't want to say that college radio is lesser because it's online. It just goes to show how it's harder to know about you know, the internet radio in your community because you can't just turn on the radio and spin the dial. Well, with that, mea culpa, I think we can talk about some news that's of importance to radio of all kinds. And one nice thing that happened as we went to air today on June 12th, as we began recording, is that the DC Circuit Court of Appeals rejected a request to put a stay on the FCC's new network neutrality rules, or the so-called open internet rules. So they actually began taking effect today, June 12th, when it was the ISPs, the Internet Service Providers Lobby, which had asked the court to stay those rules, which just went into effect. There is, nevertheless, many, many court challenges that are weaving their way through the first bits of the court system, of the appeals court system. And most observers think that those won't actually start to be heard in court until the end of the year, early next year. However, House Republicans are doing their best to try and circumvent these net neutrality rules. Right now, there's the General Appropriations Bill, which is winding its way through the halls of the House of Representatives. And the House GOP has put three riders into that appropriations bill trying to prevent net neutrality rules from taking effect. So there is tension in our forces working back and forth around net neutrality. But of course, the big question is, why is this important to radio?
Huh. Well, I heard a great definition for net neutrality yesterday, and it was that with net neutrality, the company that provides you access to the web has no control over what you do on the web.
And that's a great definition.
I loved it because it was so short.
It's simple.
Yeah. And so it's so strange that it's a partisan issue.
It is very strange. But
since
of course, when there's
the
money involved.
Too. Yeah. Right.
When there's money involved. Well, you know, the internet service providers keep saying cross their heart and hope to die. They won't actually interfere with what you see on the internet. But there's already been cases in which ISPs have throttled the bandwidth associated with Netflix or associated with BitTorrent files.
Right.
So they're not always the most trustworthy of actors in that case.
I got to go to that FCC meeting on behalf of KPFA that was held in Stanford, where they were the man who uploaded Edison cylinder recordings of Ellison's. He had an Edison cylinder collection, and he made MP3s of his Edison cylinders and uploaded them and made them available on BitTorrent. And then because he was a nerd, was able to prove that Comcast was throttling people's access to his undeniably public domain MP3s.
Of great historical significance.
And that guy was up on stage explaining in front of the audience how he figured that out and why.
And how Comcast was preventing people from hearing Edison's voice.
Right. Among, numerous other things that they were throttling in the mix.
And of course, why this is important to radio then is that, you know, the new frontiers of radio are online, whether we're accessing podcasts, whether it's streaming radio, or whether people are now streaming it to their cars, whether through their smartphones, or now there's some cars have built in 4G and wireless service. And it's about you, the listener, being able to choose what stations you want to get, and maybe not your ISP or your wireless provider saying, well, we won't charge you, or we'll charge you less to listen to iHeartMedia, and you'll pay full freight or more if you're going to be listening to KPFA or WFMU. That's, I think, one of the biggest concerns when we talk about it in terms of radio, along with the ability for folks like us or any community radio station to be able to distribute our shows and make sure that people can get our podcasts or our streams unfettered, and that it's a good, clear two-way street. Follow up on a story from last week about community station KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. That's a station that was considering selling itself to the Classical Public Radio Network because it's run into quite a bit of operating debt that it's having difficulty coming out of. But that possible plan sparked a lot of community discussion. And in response, the station has held quite a few public meetings. And as we discussed last week, floated a number of alternative plans to selling the station to the Classical Public Radio Network, including getting rid of NPR programming, which it currently airs at great expense, doing more music or doing more talk programming from less expensive or free sources, any number of different things. And Matthew reported this week, Matthew Lassar on Radio Survivor, that the KUSP's manager, Terry Green, talked with the Santa Cruz Sentinel. And Terry said, there are voices in the community strongly opposed to the sale. Terry also says, we recognize that broaching the idea at all has hit a nerve.
Huh.
Might call that a little bit of understatement. Right now, it looks like KUSP expects to make a decision on how they're going to proceed in early July, and make a public announcement shortly thereafter. So there's a station in Santa Cruz, a community station, stands at the precipice of perhaps no longer being a true community station, and there might be hope that it will be able to back away.
Do you know how much local programming there was on that station prior to this threatened sale to make it still less local?
I don't know.
It's so interesting because it seems like they touched a nerve, but I want to know what nerve that was.
I think there is plenty of community programming. I think everything that, you know, so they, I do know they air Morning Edition and All Things Considered,
right.
But I think outside the sort of drive time, there's a fair amount of local programming, especially in the evening hours.
Okay. So that's what people want to hold
That's probably really what they want to hold on to. Yeah. And we have a little bit of LPFM news, news in low power FM radio. In Texas, a new low power FM that received its construction permit, but is not yet authorized to broadcast, received temporary authority to go on the air in order to assist with emergency responses to severe flooding. And that's in the Wimberley Valley area, where flooding has taken 9 lives. Under a temporary emergency permit issued on June 5th by the FCC, Wimberley Valley Radio will broadcast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 30 days under the call letters KWVH LP on 94.1 FM.
So they're going to go 24 hours on the air with emergency programming only, like telling people.
Yeah, I doubt that it's just emergency programming. I think the purpose is that they are on the air right now, 24 hours a day, so that they can be available for alerts, provide information,
sure,
as well as probably some entertainment.
So it's like a wonderful a nod to the community value of the station, even though they hadn't finished jumping through the necessary hoops to get
in. And a good nod to the FCC for being willing to make this exception in response to quickly evolving conditions. And low power FM stations have really helped out in all sorts of natural disasters, whether during Hurricane Katrina back in 2005 or during Superstorm Sandy when it hit on the East Coast. And in part because these stations can be operated from a car battery or you know, a very small generator when the power goes out or when conditions become difficult. And they're also pretty mobile as well.
I'm aware of there was an organizing drive to get all of the Katrina refugees radios. And then they were broadcasting a low-power FM station right there from the Superdome.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, exactly. And this is a great thing. And it really highlights, I think, the community aspect of low-power FM and of broadcast radio, where, you know, in these conditions, cell towers may not be working, or even if they are, people may not be able to charge their phones, or their phones may be otherwise something they don't want to use up keep monopolized listening to internet radio.
Right.
And you can get a hand crank radio, you know, for just really like 10 or 15 bucks that can provide you that emergency communications through all sorts of circumstances. And you are listening to the Radio Survivor podcast. I'm Paul Reisman-Ell, and joining me here is Eric Klein. And you can find Radio Survivor online at radiosurvivor.com. The podcast is there. You can click on podcasts. You can get notes on the show and learn how to subscribe in iTunes and your favorite podcast listening app. And on Twitter, we're at Radio Survivor.
Well, speaking of low power FM, Paul, you set up an interview for us today with Sabrina Roach.
Thanks, Eric. Yes, on the line with us is Sabrina Roach. She is a doer with Brown Paper Tickets, working to help coordinate and organize low-power FM applicants and new stations in the Puget Sound region of Washington State. Doers at Brown Paper Tickets are community advocates and social change makers, hired to advance missions they are already passionately working on. Sabrina is certainly passionate about radio, with 15 years of experience working in both public and community stations. We're glad to have her on the podcast today to talk more about her work in Low Power FM. Welcome, Sabrina.
Thank you so much, Paul, for having me. It's fun to be here.
That's great. Let's hope it just continues to get more fun.
All the fun.
All the fun. Well, to get started, why don't you tell us more about your work with Low Power FM stations there in Seattle and the Puget Sound area?
Not sure thing. Well, we've created the Puget Sound Community Radio Cohorts, and it's a cohort because it's a learning community. The different stations in it are sharing resources and figuring this out together. I'm working with 13 of the applicants in the Puget Sound area from Bellingham to Tacoma, and that includes 7 applicants in the Seattle metro area. So far, 6 of those have their construction permits, and one is still waiting to hear about it.
And so coordinating with them, I mean, that's sort of special compared to other cities. I haven't heard of too many other areas where there's been much cooperation between low-power applicants, not because I think necessarily they don't want to, but just that that's another level of complexity over and above just getting your application in.
Well, I'm incredibly fortunate to have this job at Brown Paper Tickets because it enables me to do work that I was doing in my spare time and on nights and weekends, media justice, media reform, and community media work. Yeah, it frees me up to do it full time, and I've got, you know, travel budget, and they're really supportive. They free up some other resources of the company, like graphic design and communications help. I know that when I was working at a community radio station, KBCS, I just saw a lot of challenges, and of course opportunities in community media. But I, for Seattle with the low power FM opportunity, I just set forth this vision of, you know, hey, if we coordinated as a community and supported each other, we could have a flourishing, awesome, robust community media ecosystem in the future. And a whole bunch of people liked that idea and were game to be part of it.
And so what did you do in that time as these different groups started to think about applying for a low-power FM radio station?
Well, I had learned about low-power FM in 2006 when I went to a Prometheus Radio Project barn raising down in Woodburn, Oregon, at Picun. That's when I fell in love with it. And other folks in the area heard about that and started to learn more about it. And of course, the Local Community Radio Act wasn't signed into law until so much later. But once that happened, and that President Obama signed it into law in January of 2011, I started at Brown Paper Tickets in February of 2011. So I was able to really focus on outreach work here. There were a couple groups like Hollow Earth Radio already knew they wanted to do it. They weren't sure how they were going to do it, but they had that political will, if you will, within their organization. And it just kept growing from there. I approached some groups that seemed like they would be interested, and some of them were. I also worked with other colleagues in the media justice space doing outreach around the country. We did that in several different ways, but I really wanted to focus on Seattle when it came to developing this cohort.
And so what sort of things did you and the cohort work on together?
There was a lot of information sharing about the application itself. And we would do meetings, just regular organizing meetings, learning more about the opportunity, learning more about the specifics of the application, and also meetings to help build relationships socially. So that when some of them did apply for the same frequency, they already had a relationship and were able to figure it out instead of edging each other out. We've done some National Radio Day and World Radio Day events. National Radio Day happens in August every year, and World Radio Day, which is a United Nations, UNESCO event, that happens in February, on February 13th every year. Our most recent one can be seen online. You can actually go to a Vimeo page that we have set up, and I can send you that link, where you can see a bunch of the different Seattle area low-power FM applicants talking about why they're doing this and what they hope to do, what their vision is. And we did that at Seattle Public Library. They were really generous with their space and their time.
And can you give us a sense for some of the stations and what they want to do? What kind of of programming they want to share and how they want to interact and interface with their communities, serve their communities.
One's already on the air, and that's Voice of Vashon. And they'd been working on this for so many years, since the last opportunity when they didn't get it. They're community-based, volunteer-run. They have a pretty eclectic program schedule. There's also Seattle University Radio. So they're college radio on First Hill in Seattle. And they do some great in studios. They all cram into their little space. They've been broadcasting online as K-Sub. UW-Bothell, University of Washington at Bothell applied, and that's U-Wave Radio. They are also broadcasting online now and then. One America is going to be broadcasting from SeaTac, and that's the city where we have our airport. They'll be putting their antenna right on SeaTac City Hall. They're looking at having their studio be at one of our local community colleges. And One America is our largest statewide immigrant organizing project. So they're planning a lot of exciting things in multiple languages. So I already mentioned Hollow Earth Radio. They'll be serving the Central District and neighborhoods around that. They're freeform radio. They're volunteer run, and they grow very organically, but they've been widely recognized in Seattle as doing great work. They're able to get some grants from the city and the county. They got nominated for the Stranger Genius Award. That's our alt weekly in town. So that's really fun. Sandpoint Arts and Cultural Exchange, they're up at Magnuson Park. Sandpoint is a retired naval station, so there's a bunch of pretty cool buildings out there, and a whole lot of community-based nonprofits of various stripes. There's ones working on sustainable agriculture. There's a bunch of sports-related ones. There's a community center there and low-income housing. So they plan on being a space for all those different groups to come together and share information and, you know, arts and culture goodness. Rainier Valley Radio. Now, Rainier Valley is where I live, and they're going to be a community-based station as well, volunteer-run, with a small professional staff. They're just now figuring out, they're accepting their program proposals, so I'm excited to see how that goes. So that's a few. There's a ton.
Hi, Sabrina. It's Eric here. And so that's a great list of these applicants for Low Power FM in the Puget Sound area that you're assisting with their process. Did you just find them and know that they were in the middle of this work, or did you do any outreach to help them get this process underway?
Yeah, I want to be clear that these groups, they're supplying a whole lot of leadership and they have a lot of agency. And I'm not impacting their programming. I'm definitely sharing with them different models I've seen other places in the country and internationally. So I just want to be clear on that point. I've been really fortunate in my career. I started off at an NPR station in Seattle right out of college and was in various roles there, and one of them was as the media sponsorship coordinator, and another time part of my work there was producing an arts and culture show. So in doing that work and being from the Seattle area, I got familiar with so many different pockets of communities in Seattle, and I got insight into various silos, and that just deepened more when I was at KBCS Community Radio as their development and community engagement director. And in those jobs, I was able to connect folks doing similar work, but just get this good bird's eye view of the city and understand it more structurally. So I just was able to build on that knowledge and have a lot of different conversations. So it grew pretty organically, I'd say.
And now you said you've got, was it 7 stations that have construction permits in the Seattle area? Is that correct?
Well, within Seattle, 6 have construction permits and 1's waiting to hear.
How are they working together and how are you helping them out now that they actually have to build stations?
Well, our last meeting just a couple weeks ago, we got together and sorted out the what's next priorities. So folks in the room stress how important fundraising is for them right now, as well as community engagement and figuring out how to represent themselves visually. So pro bono graphic design is a resource I'm trying to hook them up with. Also in Seattle, we have city permits that they need to build for their antennas. And they also have to make sure that where they put their studios will fit with our zoning laws. And the group was able to work together to get the city to classify these antennas as minor communications utilities rather than major ones. So that cut maybe $10,000 out of the permitting fees. We'll be meeting quarterly to move that forward as a group, you know, that fundraising and permitting work, as well as, you know, other aspects of what they're doing. You know, and then I'll be meeting with them as individual groups through that time. But now we're just preparing for the long haul. And all of these things will take a lot of time to build.
Speaking of the long haul, I mean, one of my personal obsessions, every radio station I've volunteered or worked at, is who has the power to make decisions about the station? And are you playing any sort of role with all of these individual stations to help them with that structure?
That's a good one. They're all doing it different ways. We're seeing some emerging leadership come out of their communities as these groups hold their work sessions. Rainier Valley Radio's, the one in my neighborhood, is it's exciting to go to their meetings now and then and just see who's stepping up. So it's an interesting opportunity for groups where, you know, maybe a small core group of people worked on the application and started getting things going, and now they're trying to open up. And that's a big organizational cultural shift. Going from that small core group to creating opportunities for other community members to get engaged. So nationally, we've seen so many different models for how to do things. There's collective models, there's various forms of power sharing models, and they'll all probably be doing it a little bit different. But I'm excited with Lopar FM broadly, because organizational theory work has changed so much in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. Established full power community radio stations have tried out a lot of different things, and we can learn from what's worked and what hasn't worked really well. So there's all of that. And then there's also borrowing from other forms of governance.
I think that's a great point, and it's one that you and I have talked about, you know, off air, that there's not an obligation for two new community radio stations to have to do things exactly as established ones have. That it's not because those models don't work, but there's an opportunity to learn from both the successes and the failures of those models.
I'm more helping people to see the opportunities. We're going to see, you know, I think maybe 2,000 new LPFMs around the country. Maybe a couple hundred won't actually make it on the air. But that's, I see that as, you know, say 2,000 new anchor points for community groups to have access to the airwaves. And these anchor points, I see them as magnets. They get communities really excited. I just see so much opportunity for trying new things. And the internet makes a huge difference. The terrestrial signal, I think, for LPFM will help define place and sense of mission and bring people in those neighborhoods together. But their online presence is just as important. These stations will need to be online to reach their communities where they are at, you know, with on-demand audio, so folks can listen in when they have time to. Maybe when they're doing dishes or in their cars away from their neighborhoods. Podcasting is going to help a lot. And I think one of the historic challenges of community radio, at least, you know, at KBCS when I worked there, was just space in the program schedule. There were folks at KBCS who'd been doing amazing programming for 10, 15 years, and some a little bit more. And that doesn't make a lot of room for newcomers. But now, because we have the internet, we just have so much more space online. And folks can come to the stations have low barriers to access for tools and training. And that's exciting to me. And I think that changes how leadership gets developed.
Kind of the way you're looking at it, right, is that the low power FM station and having a real transmitter, having a real place on the dial is a platform. And it kind of gives that group and its station both some visibility in their communities as well as some sense of permanence, because an FCC license is not easy to get. And people tend to covet it more and perhaps are a little bit more invested in maintaining that because it is so hard to get compared to maybe an internet-only radio station. And yet then with this platform, there's an opportunity to expand out, right, into these other activities, whether it's podcasting or having additional internet stations or in other activities in their neighborhoods and in their communities. That sounds to me like the model you're proposing there. Is that about right?
Yeah. And I think the terrestrial signal provides a stumble upon dynamic. Folks can just be going through their dial and find something like that. That's like, you know, being at a coffee shop and stumbling upon a new zine or just a flyer for a show you might not have seen otherwise. I think we'll see a lot of innovation for, frankly, podcasting help it happen at the LPFMs. You know, with 2,000 new community media organizations, we can't help but see something shift in our community and public media landscape.
I think that's a great observation, and it's certainly something I hope for. And so maybe looking ahead, as you've done this work and you're starting to see stations come on the air and really serve their communities, is there something that you're hoping to see with low-power FMs in particular in how they serve and work with their communities? Are there some maybe new areas, some new innovations perhaps, that low-power FMs can lead the charge in helping to grow community radio?
Well, first and foremost, I have never seen this kind of enthusiasm for community media. When I worked at KBCS, it was an awesome station, but it would take people in Seattle maybe an hour, hour and a half to get there by public transportation. And LPFMs are directly in neighborhoods. You can walk to them from where you live, where you can hear them. So I just see that again as a big access issue. When it comes to innovations, I think LPFMs have this fantastic opportunity to build relationships with new kinds of institutions. And I'm not saying that some haven't already done this, because I've seen examples around the country. But there's this big opportunity to work with local public libraries and parks and rec departments, as well as maker hacker spaces. At all of those places, I've met people who have a lot in common with community media values. They're very much in alignment and would make a great fit. And some of those organizations just have different structure and different presence in their communities. Our public libraries are very established, secure community institutions. And while public libraries these days are strapped for funding, they have a lot more funding than LPFMs.
And they have a lot of resources they already possess, like community rooms and acres of books and great staff and librarians and volunteers. You know, they're established community centers, and it's not just a main library, right? It's a, you know, in a place like Seattle and in most communities, it's about branch libraries that serve neighborhoods and serve smaller portions of the community and are hyper-local in that way, even if they are networked together across a larger city, county, region.
And there's some assets they also possess that could be helpful in a few additional ways. They know how to handle archiving. They know how to structure archives. That could be really helpful to LPFMs as they develop their on-demand content. There's so much talent and institutional knowledge at libraries, and they have great community connections. So that's another helpful thing. Also, LPFM can help the libraries get deeper into their neighborhoods and get out of the walls of a library. I just see it as a really reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I've often thought of my local libraries and my local community radio stations in the same framework that these are special places apart from the mall and all these other things that you can do in the city. These are important other ways for the community to come together. So why not bring them under an umbrella? Sabrina, I'm wondering about what all this work that you're doing. You know, clearly Brown Paper Tickets pays you to do that work, and that's the role. What else do they give you so that you can get this done?
It gives me not just the salary, but also the funding for travel. And that makes it possible for me to go to national conferences and convene conversations and facilitate sessions, but also participate in things that other people make happen. So I get a lot of insight into really good stuff happening other places. And hopefully I can help connect folks who need that kind of information with each other. I'm always looking for better ways to do that.
But now I just want to know where you're going next. What's the next conference?
Well, on the 19th, I'll go to Detroit for the Allied Media Conference. I'm really excited about seeing the folks in the really rad radio and TV space. Antoine Haywood, one of my favorite folks in the public access community, will be doing some of that work, and a whole bunch of other folks. So it's always fun to get to spend some time with them. And then I'm also excited about meeting with some of the folks in the media justice space about municipal broadband and local internet choice. So broadly with my work, I'm looking at communications infrastructure for community equity. Mm-hmm. And so Low Power FM is one part of that. Low Power FM, frankly, in some sense, is a land grab of frequencies on the dial spectrum. And I see city-owned and operated internet utilities as another core piece of our community-owned communications infrastructure, to be all wonky about it. And it's good for community media, too, because of the heavy reliance on the internet for these stations. It'd be really great if they could pay lower prices for more consistent, stronger service.
Sabrina, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about all your great work. We'll put up links to Brown Paper Tickets and many of the projects you're working on in our show notes at radiosurvivor.com.
Thanks, guys. This was really fun.
So, Paul, can Radio Survivor send me to the Allied Media Conference in Detroit?
We can send you. You're going to have to pay for it.
It would be so fun. I've never been to a big conference. Do you go to conferences?
I have gone to conferences. Yes. Some big, some small. When it's come to radio, it's usually been on my own dime, though, I will have to admit.
Of course. Yeah. So what I mean, other than having a nice time and smiling, because there's so many good people around, like what do you get? What do you bring home from those things?
Depends on the conference. Sometimes networking is definitely something really important, meeting other people who are like-minded but have different perspectives, or people who share your passion but aren't like-minded. Sometimes you learn even more from, you know, and then if you're going to a conference that has panels, often those can be very informative. You can learn quite a bit. You know, it really depends on the conference, what you get out of it. I went to the Association for Community Media Conference as a regional one in Seattle back in April. The Association for Community Media is principally public access television.
Ah, public access television. It survives.
It does. And is funded, importantly. And especially in the Northwest and in the West, a lot of these stations also have radio operations. Many of them now are getting low-power FM stations. And for this particular ACM regional conference, they explicitly invited people from low-power FM and community stations. And I decided to go up there. And Sabrina Roach was there. There were folks there from all around the Northwest region. And that was great because it was interesting to hear some of the stories of the public access television stations and how they go about trying to be relevant to their communities and doing community service and balancing that often difficult balancing act between public service and public access.
Right.
Between here, you can just have a show and gauging, well, what does the community actually need and how do we serve that?
Which seems like the exact same job that a community radio station has.
Exactly. And it was great to hear the conversation between
right.
the radio and the public access TV folks sure. and to meet many of them. And so that was – it was particularly productive for me in that way, and I really appreciated having the opportunity to attend that conference. So that's just one recent example. Mm-hmm. Here in Portland last fall, we hosted the Cascadia Media Convergence, and that was interesting. And I helped to coordinate a little bit of that along with the principal organizers around radio. But they also have sort of tracks around video, film, documentary, and other types of media organizing. And that's going to happen again this fall. Here in Portland.
Okay, well, that's one that I will go to.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will bring my microphone.
You will, yes, absolutely.
Listeners to this podcast will find out whether my opinions of conferences evolve.
But another way you can help us go to conferences is you can help us out with our Patreon campaign, which helps radio survivors survive. It helps us not rely on things like advertisers and or little pennies from Amazon.com. It's really taking that basic funding model of community radio and applying it to our website and podcast. At Patreon, you become a patron by agreeing to donate some amount every month. Could be a dollar, could be two, could be 10 or more. And that helps us continue to do our good work. Go to patreon.com/radiosurvivor, and it'll help us do the podcast and let us really grow the amount of coverage we do, and especially maybe attend conferences or attend other events, which would then allow us to share a lot of that great information and a lot of the shared expertise with listeners of this podcast, as well as to readers of radiosurvivor.com. So we'll hope you give it a shot. We'll hope you'll consider it. Patreon.com, patreon.com/radiosurvivor. And if you have any comments, I set up an email address, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. We'd love to hear from you. We've already got a few comments.
Oh.
We'd love to hear from you. What you'd like to hear more of, what you'd like to hear less of. We're looking for tips. Who are some great people who more people should know about? What are some great projects, some great radio shows, great podcasts that you think deserve more attention? Send it to us, podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Well, next on Radio Survivor, we're going to get an update on what's new in the world of college radio with Jennifer Waits.
Hi, Jennifer. So you're ready to get us up to date with what's going on in college radio?
I'm excited to get you up to date about college radio.
Great. Well, I know that you've been following college radio preservation. It's something that you mentioned in our last episode, and you have some updates this week.
Yeah, there's this great article by Laura Schnicker in Antenna called Saving College Radio, and she talks about her experience at WMUC at University of Maryland and how she ran across all this amazing archival material there. Just sitting there in the radio station. And since she works in the university archives, she was able to move a lot of these incredible collections over to the archives. And I'll do a quote from her. She said that radio stations have been notoriously remiss in preserving their histories. And so she's calling for college radio stations to work with their university archivists to start maintaining histories and archives. And she says it's actually quite easy. And most colleges and universities have built-in resources to save these materials.
Wow. And so what kind of materials did she find there at WMUC?
She said she found over 1,800 audio reels, cartridges, cassettes, and DATs. And they were just stacked floor to ceiling. And I've been to the station. It's jam-packed with all kinds of amazing stuff. So she found a recording of Don McLean, and he was doing an early version of American Pie on WMUC, and that was just kind of in a pile at the station. And so after she was able to get it over to the archives, you know, now that can be preserved and other people can hear it and learn more about the history of Americana music.
Wow. So part of the importance here then is not just the history of the station, but it seems like the history of lots of other things, whether it be music or it could be politics or news, might also be sitting in these stacks.
Yeah. I mean, like I've mentioned before on Radio Survivor, a lot of college radio stations were the first to report, you know, events like John F. Kennedy getting shot. Often students first heard about that from their college radio stations. So there are records and recordings of the reporting of that incident in college radio archives. Also student protest movements.
Right. So she's calling upon stations to get a hold of the archivists and they're usually probably in their libraries on campus to see how they can work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And she says, and this is something I truly believe, that campus radio stations are part of university life and that their history should be in the university archives. And this happened at my college, at Haverford College. Somebody had the foresight to set up an archive of college radio materials from the Haverford College radio stations that date back to the 1920s. And it's because they saw that it was an important part of student life that, you know, people want to look back on in the future.
Right. And an effort similar to that is going on at WPRB in Princeton, New Jersey, correct?
Yeah. In fact, Mike Lupica, who's the educational advisor at WPRB at Princeton, he attended a college radio symposium at University of Maryland that Laura Schnitker put on last year. And I met Mike there, and he told me he was starting to work on a history project. I think he was inspired by the efforts at University of Maryland. And WPRB is about to celebrate 75 years of broadcasting. So they have a website, wprbhistory.org, that it's really an in-progress site, which I think is a fabulous idea because it sort of takes the pressure off building a complete history, you know, and then posting it.
Right.
So it's an ongoing project. He has photos, stories, audio, video, information from different decades of the station. And a lot of the first-person stories from people who participate in the station are incredible. There was one from somebody who talked about, I majored in radio station, which I think a lot of people can relate to, that, you know, their time at their campus radio station took over their college career. And it really, for all intents and purposes, was their major.
Very cool. And another thing that you kind of been covering is the budgets at some stations, right? Because many college stations are funded pretty heavily by their universities or by student dollars often, or student union dollars. And there's two stations you've been following.
College radio stations are all funded so differently. There are so many different ways for it to work. But Portland State's college radio station, KPSU, it's an online station, and they just found out that their budget has been cut 40%, and their budget's been decreasing gradually. So in 2010, it was $196,000, and next year it will be $64,000. So they're not pleased about that. KPSU was hoping to get a low-power FM license, but they lost out on that opportunity. So that was also sad news for them. But it sounds like they're still doing really great as far as their web stream, and they do a lot of events. So they feel like they're really succeeding and reaching a lot of people. So I think it's disappointing to them to have their budget cut, even though they feel like they're doing a great job.
Now, was the failure to get a low power FM, is that related to the budget cut? Was it a sense in which somebody in charge said, well, we thought you were going to do this, but since you're not, you don't need so much money?
Yeah, it's unclear in the reporting that I'm reading. It's from an article in Willamette Week, and they did not get a comment from the student fee committee. So we don't know the full details on that.
Okay, so this is a student committee then, which is making these decisions, not an administrator.
Yeah, the student fee committee does the budgets for student organizations like the radio station. And then another station that's facing a budget cut is KDVS at University of California, Davis. So they do on-air fundraising to get some of their budget, but they also get money from the Student Senate. And the Student Senate cut the subsidy for the radio station. So it sounds like that's not the full budget for the station, but you know, they get some money from the Student Senate, and that amount has been cut by about $10,000 this year.
Was any rationalization given for that cut?
Well, it sounds like the Student Senate was charged with reducing their overall budget across all organizations that they gave money to. So KDVS was just part of that. But KDVS actually, when this meeting was coming up, they galvanized and got a bunch of station members to go to the meeting in order to preserve their budget. So rather than it being a protest, it was more they wanted to have a show of support that student media is important and we don't want to have our budget cut.
So turn it into a discussion.
Yeah.
Well, and then you have a little more fun news about an interesting broadcast that just happened at your home station, KFJC.
Yeah, so KFJC, it's the Foothill College station south of San Francisco in Los Altos Hills, and it's a community college station, and something KFJC is known for is international live remotes. How many people do that? So last weekend, on June 5th and 6th, KFJC broadcast from the Eindhoven Psych Lab, which was a festival in the Netherlands. KFJC volunteers flew over to Europe and managed this two-day live remote broadcast that included audio and video.
So psych bands, for people who don't know what that means or who think that's bands full of psychologists, give us a description of what that means.
Psychedelic music. I mean, it's a wide array of bands. Some of them maybe harken back to psychedelia from the 60s, a lot of guitars. Some were heavier sounding, some were droney.
So would you say when you talk about the 60s, you mean following on something from like Pink Floyd, but or even something like the Strawberry Alarm Clock or thing, you know, the 11th floor elevators or something like that?
Yeah. And psychedelia is an international tradition. So there were bands from Japan, from the United States, from the Netherlands. It's interesting to hear all their different takes on it.
Cool. So and my question is, how does KFJC fund this? Sending people overseas?
Most people paid their own way.
Okay.
So it's a pretty low budget. You know, I think they had to buy some new gear for the live remote. They may have borrowed some gear.
So it sounds like for the volunteers, it's a labor of love. They wanted to go and they're sort of bringing, they're very nice and they're bringing along KFJC listeners and online viewers for the ride.
Yeah.
Is there any way that we can catch up on it after the fact?
Well, we have KFJC does, we have 2 week archives. So the festival was June 5th and 6th. So for 2 weeks after that, you can tune in to the broadcast archives at kfjc.org and catch bits and pieces of the bands and interviews that DJs did with the bands. And you can see photos on our Facebook page.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jennifer, for catching us up on everything going on in college radio. And of course, people can catch up with your weekly college radio updates at College Radio Watch at our website, radiosurvivor.com. And then up on the upper left, click on College Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, I think it's occurred to me now that there's a theme going with this program.
Yeah.
And it's that librarians and libraries and archivists and community radio or good radio, there's an opportunity for partnerships that hasn't taken place yet, and maybe these groups of individuals should be working closer together than they have been in the past. And what's funny about that is that, well, last week we spoke with Cheyenne Homan, who is the newly hired director of the Free Music Archive, which, if you don't remember, is an online archive of very good songs that are all Creative Commons copyrighted, which means you can download them for free. And it's an archive that is operated by radio station WFMU.
So there you have a great collaboration between artists, archivists, and radio.
Right. And it's what's funny is that when they started, I think they just had one of their FMU folks running the thing. But by hiring Cheyenne Homan, what they've done is they've hired a librarian and an archivist who has community radio or college radio experience.
And last week you mentioned that Cheyenne hosts a podcast for the Free Music Archive where she gets into a lot of these issues. And you promised to tell us more about that podcast and play us some clips to get us excited about it.
So I spent some time listening to Radio Free Culture, the podcast that comes out of the Free Music Archive that is hosted and produced by Cheyenne Homan. And, you know, it's a really... you know, absorbing all of that material was quite an educational experience into the world of, you know, what's really happening at the cutting edge of people creating stuff online. Or what's happening, you know, really is that they're creating stuff. And if you have a desire for the stuff you create to exist at all in the world that we live in, it's going to be on the web.
It's people who are at the cutting edge of creating and sharing.
Right.
Really.
Yeah, because you can make a whole lot of stuff in your basement and leave it there. But if you want other people to know about it, it's going to be online. And, you know, that's a really big picture. And if you're interested in that stuff, then I do recommend listening to the Radio Free Culture podcast. I've brought some clips that I think focus down a little bit, you know, put the magnifying glass more on the kinds of issues that Radio Survivor, you know, the overlap with what we want to talk about. And, you know, starting off, we're going to hear Cheyenne Homan just talking about how she really got a crash course as when she took over in what kind of community she had found herself in.
The Creative Commons community and the Netlabel community, which I didn't know much about before, is really vast and full of these amazingly creative people that I think would not have the same amount of exposure if it weren't for a site like the FMA.
Yeah, so the FMA really did become, you know, accidentally a hub for that community, because originally it was founded by the radio station WFMU as a PodSafe library. Just they had some fear that the way things were going, they'd be thrown offline, that their radio station would no longer be able to broadcast over the internet without this PodSafe music. And what it evolved into was a place where people could reach out and find other people making things and collaborate, both for money and for free. And, you know, Cheyenne Homan, she spoke with Ken Freeman at one point on Radio Free Culture, and he talked about how, despite the fact that what they're originally afraid of happening, being shut down on the internet, didn't happen, why he still hasn't let down his guard. I think that was really interesting.
It still exists for the original purpose that it was set up. And still in my mind, you can't be too safe about copyright issues. And I'm still concerned that these laws are still out there, despite the fact that this battle didn't go the way so many people expected it to, which is great. But there's still these terrible laws on the books. The DMCA is just awful, and it has not been repealed yet. And there's all sorts of rules out there that could be used as a cudgel against all sorts of non-commercial and public radio stations and independent webcasters and hobbyist webcasters. So the Free Music Archive does exist for that, but that is true. It's not getting used on that basis day to day. But that's one of the reasons why I really still believe in it and I'm really 100% committed to keeping it going. And meanwhile, it's serving a super important purpose to producers and artists. So I'm really happy about that.
And it is still getting used by DJs, certainly at WFMU. And as you mentioned last week, there are other radio stations which have created their own curated archives of music that they've procured or they've recorded themselves that are shared on the FMA. So it does still seem to be performing a little bit of this service, even if it's
right.
Not quite how Ken and others at WFMU would have predicted 8 years ago when they were most concerned about really having their web streams taken offline because they simply couldn't broadcast their regular over-the-air streams the way they had become used to doing.
Right. Yeah. And, well, the other, you know, it's interesting that radio stations had these concerns. And another thing that I learned by listening to Radio Free Culture, the podcast, when Cheyenne interviewed a gentleman who runs a community arts center and performance space in Providence, Rhode Island. She spoke with Jacob Nathan of the art space is called AS220. And they are experiencing similar pressures that a radio station might experience, which I thought was so interesting to take it out of the radio space and bringing it into the meat space. They're still struggling with the same thing, and the Free Music Archive has sort of become a solution for them.
So what do you see as the relationship between AS220 and the Free Music Archive?
Well, one interesting thing to note about all of the AS220 performance spaces, which kind of, I think in many ways it naturally led to us getting involved with you, is that we have an all original music policy at the performance spaces, which comes out of a boycott that has existed at AS220 since its inception against the performing rights organizations like ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, boycotting the blanket licensing system that they have for copyrighted material.
Yeah, and so Jacob Nathan there goes into great detail about how upsetting and Byzantine that process was of LiveSpace handing over a check to the music industry that was sort of unaccountable. They didn't seem to be, he said that they said, well, we don't play any of that music. And they were told, well, how do you know?
And so
pay up
by turning to something like the Free Music Archive, where it's full of music that is not being managed by these rights associations. It's a part in how they can prove that, but also stay true to their own ethic.
Right.
We're here to encourage local culture. We're here to encourage original expression. Let's just bypass this whole thing. And as a result, we can't play licensed music in our performance spaces. So we can play Creative Commons and we can play public domain. So we rely really heavily on the Free Music Archive just for music to be playing in our space, like in between sets and for use in those spaces.
So that was Jacob Nathan, who works with the art space AS220. And Cheyenne Homan on the podcast Radio Free Culture talks to lots of interesting people like this. Another guest that she had on a separate podcast was Emily Salt of the for-profit company Pop-Up Archive. I think Pop-Up Archive is sort of, it's like a startup. It's like a tech startup. And what they're doing should be really interesting to Radio Survivor listeners. They are trying to address the fact that the written word is king on the internet, especially as far as discovery goes and search. And they're trying to open up all of the podcasts and radio to search, to make it easier to find and easier to access.
The internet is a medium that searches text. Like, that's how it's all designed. Like, that's how anything is found in a search engine, is through words. And so, you know, it doesn't matter how much amazing, great content is in this Bob Dylan interview. If there are no words to go along with it, then nobody's ever going to find it. And it's expensive, especially for big archives, for someone who's like been on the air for 45 years to have a human go through and do all of that. So that was a use case where it made a lot of sense for them to use these machine transcripts and machine tagging that we do to really just like open up all this content that's like sort of trapped in the black box of sound, to put it in sort of epic sounding terms.
So yeah, Pop-Up Archive has apparently been working with the Kitchen Sisters, the radio producers, as well as people in control of Studs Terkel's archive to make that stuff more internet friendly.
More searchable by text and therefore more accessible, because it also opens it up to people who may not hear well.
It's all covered on Radio Free Culture.
Radio Free Culture, where can people find that?
It's hard to find. Well, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Yeah. And then it's up there on the Free Music Archive, and the most recent episodes are easy to find.
And we'll go ahead and put a link at our website at radiosurvivor.com. Click on podcast. You'll find the notes for this show, and we'll make sure to have a link right to it so that they can find it. And we'd love to hear about other podcasts or other radio shows or other projects that you think are interesting and deserve more coverage, that more people should know about. Send us an email to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Eric, thanks for diving in to hours of Radio Free Culture and sharing with us some excellent excerpts.
It was really my pleasure. I can't wait to binge on another great podcast.
And now we're going to hear from our man in San Francisco and Santa Cruz, Matthew Lassar.
Hi there, Radio Survivor fans. This is Matthew Lassar, co-founder of Radio Survivor with my second podcast entry, so to speak, in which I'm going to talk about the five things I do when I hear weird music on the radio. In the last entry I did, I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Matthew Lassar. I am one of the co-founders of Radio Survivor. I'm the author of two books on the history of the Pacifica Radio Network. One is Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, and it's about the early years. And Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio, Civil War is about the later years. And I'm writing a book now about radio in the internet radio era of the last 20 years or so. And I live in San Francisco, and I teach at UC Santa Cruz. And I've written quite a number of articles for Radio Survivor. And that's it. That's about me. Yes, the five things I do when I hear weird music on the radio. Where does this meditation come from? Well, a couple of years ago, I was driving down the San Francisco Bay Area Highways 280, which I use to get from my home in San Francisco to UC Santa Cruz, where I teach and live part-time. And I was listening to one of my favorite college radio stations, Foothills Junior College, KFJC-FM, where our colleague Jennifer Waits does a radio show. And some really, really weird music came on. And as I recall, it was a duet between a fire engine siren and a penny whistle. Yes, a fire engine siren and a penny whistle. That's what it was. And it went on and on. And every now, first the fire engine siren would come on and go, and then the penny whistle come in and go, woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. I can't do them both at the same time. I can't do an imitation of them both at the same time, but it sounded like that. And it just kept on going and going. And I began to track my own behavior in response to this music. And KFJC plays lots of music like this, which is one of the many things that makes it so wonderful. And I noticed that I always do the same five things whenever I hear something really strange on the radio, or something that I experience is really strange on the radio. Number one, I start looking at the radio. I don't know why I do this. I mean, what do I expect? That the radio is going to look back at me and look at me and go, what? You know, my look is like, why are you playing this piece? Or, you know, what are you doing? And the radio, of course, never responds. Thank God. I mean, you know, if it did respond, I'd probably, you know, drive off a cliff or something like that. But anyway, I look at the radio a lot when this kind of music is happening. Second thing that happens is that I keep debating with myself whether I want to keep listening. I mean, after the first 10 minutes or 15 minutes of a fire engine siren versus a penny whistle, you know, it's very interesting and yet it's taxing at the same time. So I ponder whether I want to keep listening. The thing that usually keeps me around for sure is curiosity about the identity of the piece, so I stay. And number three, I start to wonder who wrote the piece. And I like to think that I'm a big expert on contemporary experimental avant-garde music, which I'm not, of course, but I like to think that I am. I rummage around the disheveled card catalog that is my brain, trying to identify the author of the composition. You know, Brian Eno, Milton Babbitt, Laurie Anderson, Frank Zappa. And I often don't get the composer right, but I always impress myself with the sheer volume of weird music maker names that I can recall that are in the card catalog, which is my mind. Number four, I argue with myself over whether the radio station should be playing this kind of music. I mean, I
you know, is somebody else listening to this? Is this alienating listeners? You know, I have all kinds of thoughts about community radio, which I've written about in the two books I've written about community radio. The great elitism versus reaching out to the masses debate churns away in my mind. As for me, the issue, you know, it never gets resolved. I just sort of sit there and churn it around in my head. And finally, somebody comes on and says what this piece is, and I berate or congratulate myself for having identified the composer or not. If the announcer comes on and IDs the composer and I can write, I'm very pleased with myself. Of course, I usually give myself at least partial credit if I'm close. If I'm way off base, I feel a little embarrassed, then it occurs to me that I have just been introduced to something new, at least for me, and that's good too. And thank you, Community College Radio, for expanding my horizons. That sort of thought. That's number five of my the five things I think, mostly think, not do, when I hear weird music on the radio. I think I'll sign off at this point, having introduced myself and explained the five things I think when I hear weird music on the radio.
Thank you, Matthew, and I hope this podcast does not force you to have to do any of those five things. All right, we come to the end of number two, Eric.
We did it.
We've done it.
And you listened to it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. We do really want to know what you think. Send us an email.
It's really important.
It is really important. We want to make this as interactive as possible. And, you know, if you can find a way to send us an audio file commentary one way or another, Dropbox it, send it to us an email.
Yeah, record it in your voice app if you have a smartphone and email it to us.
Yeah, however you can figure it out.
Let us know if we can play it on the podcast because we probably want to.
That's exactly what we want to do. We'd love to include many more voices, and we want to be the ringleaders here, maybe, or maybe just sort of the masters of ceremonies, passing the mic and highlighting highlighting great things. So if you can do any of that, you got something to say, send it to us, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. You can also tweet us. We're at Radio Survivor. You can find us on Facebook as well. The website, of course, is radiosurvivor.com.
Tell us your definition of good radio.
Yes. What is your definition of good radio? I think we'll make sure to highlight that question at the beginning next time around. But that's great. Send it to us. podcast@radiosurvivor.com. As well, you can help us out a lot if you go to iTunes and you subscribe to the podcast there. It's great also if you rate it. There's a star rating system if you give it a rating. And if you want to give it a review, that's even better. That will help us rise in the ranks there at iTunes, and more people can find the show. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Paul.